Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to Nightlight, everybody. I'm so glad you could join me tonight because this is the beginning of a series of 8 shows that I am so excited about. I am able to read one of my favorite books, which is the Genesis 6 Conspiracy, for the 4th or 5th time. And it's an amazing book. I highly recommend it. I recommend you reading it more than once. Earlier this year, we went through his Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, section by section, and I found it terribly enlightening and exciting, and everyone really had such a great time with it. I said, you know, well, let's do book 1, and to be able to go through book 1 again has been an absolute gift. This first section is on the antediluvian Enoch and the age of great heroes, and Gary brings such great insight and such great wisdom, and truly, if you buy the book and read it section by section, as I'm doing with him now over the next 7 weeks, you'll be able to dig as deeply into this as I'd like to. I'd almost think, you know, given a year, we're going to have to do it again because there's so much more here. But before that, welcome to the show, Gary. I'm so glad that we're able to do this. I'm so excited.
Yeah, so happy to be back with you and looking forward to doing the series on the book. I think it's one of the most unique books that's on the marketplace, and it answers so many questions for people in terms of what was and what is, and hopefully shed some light on where the future is headed as well. So it's going to be an interesting ride, and I'm hoping that the audience is going to enjoy it.
Well, they have to. How could they not? You have done such an extraordinary amount of research into this. And I mean, the number of books that you've delved into and brought into play here to sort of put meat on everything. You know, when you read everything in the Bible cold, there's great worth in reading the Bible. Lots of people just get great, wonderful things from it. I get questions all over the place. So reading your book, explaining and bringing a greater insight into the times and the people and what was going on, makes everything so much more real. And while it does give you a tremendous amount of information, it also brings up tons of questions, which mean you go and research and you learn so much more. So I thank you for confusing me and making me curious and sending me back to the books.
Well, that's the whole idea, is to make people think and to dig deeper so that they can make better decisions as to what they believe, because a lot of times we just go along in this world and we believe what we're told to believe. And I'm a, you know, a Christian contrarian, so I tend not to accept just what people say, and I like to verify things myself, and I would encourage people to do that so that you're very assured of why you believe what you believe. So, and this book has challenged a lot of people to go back and rethink a few things, and I think that's, you know, one of its enduring sort of factors. It's a book that's been out for, you know, it was originally published in 2015, and it sells more books year after year. We'll see whether or not that happens this year, but it's on a very good pace this year, as is book two. So it has a shelf life, and people tend to use it as a kind of a reference book because of how it's set up, that you can at least get into the zone of what you're looking for when you have a question based on the chapter names and dig it out for information. So, and one of the tricks that I try and do in both of the books is to try and do it with a bit of a narrative, so that it's like a, almost like a quest or a search or a journey, and that it continues and it just keeps opening up more doors for people to consider.
Well, yeah, a lot of the books that you referenced are, now I have the Book of Enoch, and I have Josephus, and I have the Gnostic Gospels. Lawrence Gardner is a wonderful author. Some of the others, Albert Mackey and Masonic History, are books or areas that, you know, I don't have reference to. And then, of course, Scribes of the Time. And you said something very interesting, too, that the scribes of recorded history and prehistory, they wanted us to look into and investigate stuff. They gave us hints, but they didn't give us actuality, so that it does send us into researching and trying to figure out and find out exactly what those times were like. And the book is wonderful. I'm having a wonderful time rereading it. And, you know, let's start out with the Nephilim, who they were and why were they on the earth?
Yeah, very, very good place to start. And I would encourage people, if you have a copy of my book, or if you're actually go out and purchase one or receive one somehow, some way, is do read the preface, because what I do in the preface is I talk a little bit about the difficulty in the journey in writing the book. And I underline some of those authors that Barbara was just talking about. And I lay down some of the things that you want to pay attention to. And, you know, as I was reading some of the Gnostic Gospels, there was in the Tripart Tractate, there was this secretive ancient organization. And it was actually just called the Organization. That controlled things. And that is one of those things that most people don't really want to take a step back and think about. Is there people or beings behind the scenes that are controlling things? And that's kind of part of a big part of the context of what the Genesis 6 conspiracy is all about. So in Genesis 6, we get the creation of, in the King James Version Bible, they called the giants. And if you have a NIV and some other translations, and I used the NIV in book one, and I used the KJV in book two, in the NIV, it calls them the Nephilim. And that's a term that not everybody is familiar with, depending on which translation you are and whether or not you're Christian or not. And it says in Genesis 6:4 that the sons of God went to the daughters of men, and they took any of them they chose, and they produced with them giants or Nephilim. And so that's a very controversial, you know, set of verses 1 through 4. And it's in the preamble to the flood story. And it's part of the context for the flood story. And most people just sort of chop that part off And I get it. When I first started to come back to Christ and started to read the Bible and I wanted to track all the prophecy narratives, I kept getting to Genesis 6 and I'm reading Giants and I'm going, I don't want anything to do with that. Whatever that's talking about, that's not what I'm here to do. And that's just crazy talk. I get the cognizant dissonance. And so much so that's a common feeling even throughout Christianity, that churches do not teach prehistory. They do not teach about giants, and they do not teach prophecy for the most part. And it's unfortunate because that's the whole context for the Bible. And so we're leaving out most of the context. So the sons of God produce with human females giants. And we know this is an actual giant. It's not an exaggeration because when we look at that word Nephilim and its meaning, not only does it mean giant and tribe of giants, it also means bully and also means tyrant. Those two words are not alternate definitions. Those are nuances to the definition because these were the bullies. These were the tyrants. And if you look at ancient history, particularly with the parent gods, but also with the tradition of the offspring gods after the flood, bulls were the gods. For the angels, and that their offspring, the giants, were also called bulls. And that's where the word bully comes from. And biblically, when we get Christ on the cross and he's surrounded by the bulls of Bashan, that is who is surrounding and mocking Jesus on the cross. And these are probably the invisible ones, and they're not showing up physically. There's humans there, but these ones would probably be in a spiritual form. And those are the demons, are the disembodied spirits of the giants. And these are the spirit forms of the fallen angels. They're the bulls. And it's important to understand that the bull cult was part of that ancient religion, but that's sort of getting ahead of ourselves. And then the other word is tyrant, and it goes back to Tyrannos. And Tyrannos was the name for the tyrant kings, which were demigod kings, which were the Gyges kings, or Gyes in the plural aspect of the bloodline of the Herculean kings, or Herculides kings, in this dynastic bloodline. And all the giants were known as giants, were known as tyrants, and the terrible ones, which is the Hebrew word that is cognate for the tyrants, and terrible ones is the Eretim, as the terrible ones are taken back to Hebrew that are talked about as tyrants in Ezekiel 32. These potentates are the tyrants. These are the terrible ones. They're the same terms. So we need to understand that these are actually giants, and they are hybrid beings. They are the offspring. These are the offspring of the fallen angels, or the gods, as they're known in polytheism, and human females. And so they take on the traits of their celestial mafia godfathers, as I tongue-in-cheek like to call them.
Well, wait, before you go further here, this is where I want to get into this too. When people think about, you know, these were... And angels took the form of humans in order to mate with women. But the angels were not the golden-haired with halos and harps. The angels, they're different levels of angels, and they looked different, and they were not pretty. I mean, sometimes probably the giants looked prettier than the actual form of the angel that sired them. And I think people have to understand, them. Many of the higher realms actually were serpentine. They had faces and heads of snakes. So
it's such a game changer to understand that, and that these are seraphim angels, which are recorded in Isaiah 6. And seraphim is the plural of the Hebrew word seraph. And these are six-winged, serpent-faced angels that have a fiery copper color to them. And these are watcher angels, part of the four watcher groups, part of the sons of God that are mentioned in Genesis 6. And that These were also understood as dragons in ancient ology. And so when we look at serpent gods and dragon creator gods, they're talking about seraphim. And it's not vivid imagination. These are the Araeus gods, like even with the offspring gods like Anki and Enlil, son of Anu, a parent god, also a Araeus god or a serpentine god, Osiris, Isis, Zeus, they're all originally depicted as serpents. And once we sort of understand that not all angels had human faces, some of them did. Archangels have a human face. One deduces from the accounts in the Bible that the lowest level of angel, and understand that this is an army of angels, both loyal and rebellious. So the gods and the angels that follow heaven, they have a hierarchy to it. And that this hierarchy has different orders of angels as you go up and down the columns of the hierarchy. So when we look at, let's say, an Anunnaki, which is also a watcher, or a Gigi, which goes back to the same word as watcher, meaning eye, ear, as in to watch, in Daniel 4, where it says watcher four times. And in Sumerian, the Anunnaki, they're also known as the Gigi gods, which goes back to references to the eye and to watch. And these are watcher gods, even in polytheism. And when we look at some of the reliefs of Anunnaki, for example, you would get an image of very stocky beings that are doing a ritual around a tree. They have wings on them, so we know they're angels. And one has the face of a bird. And there's an identical set of reliefs that shows the same setting, but they have a human head with dark hair and dark curly black beards. And so these are two faces of a cherubim. And the other two faces of a cherubim is a lion and a bull. Some people translate as an ox, but I think bull is the common sort of understanding coming out of ancient prehistory and history, and that when they took a physical form, they would display only one of those faces. So when you see cherubim, they could be displayed as a sphinx that could have a human head or a lion head. Or as you move through the Middle East, then you've got the carabs, for example, and they can have a bull head or a bird head. And gargoyles are a form of the bird-headed ones that are shown on some of the Gothic cathedrals.
So was the earth originally populated by the angelic realm before God introduced man?
One deduces yes, and in maybe perhaps more than one period. So that if we look at day six, for example, and I think day six is a different creation than the Adam account that happened sometime after day seven. The story is inconsistent, so that would put the Bible in contradiction. So I don't believe the Bible would be in contradiction, so I look at those as two separate creations, and the Adamites are created for a special purpose. And I think the people of day six are going to be led astray by other beings and the fallen angels. And so there's also an interesting passage in 2 Peter 3, and I'll probably reference it a couple of times tonight, where you have a day is like 1,000 years. So you could have 1,000 years from the beginning of day six to the end of day six, and then the beasts of the field are created before the humans are in day six. So it could be up to 1,000 years before, and day seven could have been 1,000 years, and we have no idea how long there is after day seven because there's no day eight. But sometime later, you have Adam created in a different way than the humans on day six. And so you have a beast of the field that is going to deceive Adam and Eve, and this is the Nahash, or the serpent being. And that they, as you take that back to its source word, Nahash, the same spelling, It means a sorcerer or necromancer, so essentially a priest of polytheism that is partnering with Satan, who's also described as a serpent, and a few other descriptions, as well as a cherubim and a morning star and some other descriptions, is going to cause the fall of Adam and Eve. And then you could have 1,000 years of each of the days before that where there would have been no beings, and but the angels would still have been ruling. And if you look at, as a lot of people believe, and I think you can make a very good case, and I mentioned this throughout book one as well, just as I reference the difference of day six to the Adam account to understand history, you can translate Genesis 1-2 as the world was void and formless, but became void and formless. And that's tuho and buhu on void and formless, and it means to ruin or destroy. I won't go through the whole case for it on the show tonight, but you can get a document from me that I'll send you at no charge if you want to walk through the language of the verses and take it back to the Hebrew, which will show you, and it'll also match up with the 2 Peter 3 again. But it fits better with how we understand this world and the angelic rebellion, that the angelic rebellion reigned before Genesis 2, when the Ruach or the Holy Spirit is there to renew the face of the earth. Just as Psalms 104 says, when God sends his spirit, the earth is renewed. This is a passage that has a retelling of more information, or not a retelling, but adding more information about creation, including the creation of the angels. And that that's what's going on here, is a renewal of the earth, and the spirit is shown there in Genesis 1-2 hovering over the chaos. And so the thought is that the angelic war with the angelic technology, which is again important information and context that you need to understand prehistory and before the flood, that this was a level of technology that could destroy the world down to its foundations and cause the waters above to collapse onto the waters below and destroy the earth down to the foundations and perish the world by fire, as 2 Peter 3 talks about. And it's the world that was in the water and out of the water. And the world that perished isn't the flood story in this water. This is the angelic rebellion. And we have no idea how long they would have ruled before or how many types of creatures and things that they would have created in that period of time. And also understanding that is that the chief watchers were seraphim. They were, according to most church fathers and the standard hierarchy, were, you know, at the apex. And I think they may have been second from the apex, but or there may have been a reversal of rank after the rebellion. But watcher angels as seraphim, they would have preferred a being that looked like them, as serpents. So you can now imagine why the Nahash serpent as beings, before they lost their speech, before they lost their intelligence, before they lost their legs or wings and legs, and were thought to be as tall as a camel, would have been their preferred being. And that's why they're so also associated with kingship. And that in that time, in that gap before the renewal of the earth between Genesis 1 and Genesis 1-2, is that they could have reigned for billions of years and created all sorts of different creatures. And with the rebellion that was unsuccessfully waged, the earth was destroyed with that weaponry. Now, if you look at the pantheons all around the world, you have, as I said, you have these serpentine gods all over the world, whether it's the feathered serpent or the plumed serpent, like Quetzalcoatl. It's the dragon creator gods in India. You also have the Naga gods, and in India, I mean the dragon creator gods in China. And they all, in those accounts, created giants. So they're telling the same story. And if they took that physical form, they would have created DNA, and then their offspring would have looked just like them. And so when you look at the kingships associated with serpent imagery, That's because the original Nephilim and the original giants after the flood would have looked like their celestial mafia parents. And so that's why serpentine imagery, that's why the Nephilim were depicted in that way all around the world, with very strange heads and with that serpentine image.
It sounds like, too, that the giants of old were twice as big as the giants that, you know, when you come down to, 14, 15 feet high when you're talking, you know, further along in Genesis. But these original giants were much bigger, Pierce.
Yeah, we don't know how big the antediluvian giants were. Some people think as tall as 500 feet.
Uh-huh.
And they get that out of the Book of Enoch with a term being used in the Aramaic translation of cubits. And they were stated to be 300 cubits. And a standard cubit is a foot and a half, so that would be 450 feet. But the Giaz version, which is an older version being handed down, again, not in the Hebrew, the term is L, E-L-L. We don't know what that measurement is. And I think cubit was put in to the Aramaic version of the Dead Sea Scrolls just because they didn't know what an L was. So we want to be careful with that. Typically, somewhere between 20 and 40 feet tall would be the size of what most people land on for the size of the antediluvian giants, but I leave it open that they could be higher because Mount Hermon, which is where the oath was taken by the fallen angels by the 200 to create the spurious race, this hybrid race, was on Mount Hermon, where the Mount Hermon evergreen is used in reference to in the Book of Amos to the Amorites, which are hybrids, but still for a giant-like being. And that would be human giant hybrid versus human angel hybrid in the distinction between the hybrids. And those trees could grow to be 100 feet tall and 50 feet wide. And a typical 2-to-1 height to width ratio in the beginning, just as Og's Bad was 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide, that 2-to-1 ratio again, because these were stout creatures. They just weren't gangly and tall. And so 20 to 40 feet is what most people think, but because of that comparative in a simile to the evergreen cedars of Mount Hermon, you have to be open they could be even taller than that. But again, hard to know. Whereas after the flood, the tallest giant we get that I'm familiar with is Gilgamesh, sixth generation after the flood, son of Lugalbanda, king of Uruk, and the fertility goddess and a bull goddess, Nin. He was 19 feet tall, and he was king of Uruk, so he'd use the 21-inch royal cubit, just as Josephus says, use 21 inches in the length to describe the giants, because they're royals, and they were measured on the royal cubit, and that he was 11 cubits tall and 4 cubits wide, so 7 feet wide and 19 feet tall. King Og would have been, based on his bed, probably 14 to 15 feet tall, and was the last of the giants of the Rephaim in the first generation after the flood. And he would have been 4 to 6 feet wide because the bed was 4 feet wide. So yeah, there's a difference in size. They were significantly bigger. Not that the giants after the flood weren't huge, but they were significantly bigger. I just wanted to go back and touch on something that comes out of Pistis Sophia. And it's in chapter 4 of this Gnostic gospel, and it's a reference to the archons or the watchers that are in the pit prison or the abyss prison. And these would be parent gods from before the flood. And so what happened to the watcher angels is for the ones who violated the crimes of creation and the 200 that are mentioned in Book of Enoch, and any other angel that would have violated the laws of creation, they went to the pit prison for their punishment at the time of the flood. So in this, it's talking about many kinds of watchers that are in this pit prison. And it, chapter, book 4, 126, starting in about verse 32, and it goes right through to 322. So it's a big one. So I won't, obviously won't go through all of it, but I'll talk about some of the these fallen angels that were sort of at the top end of the hierarchy that were in there. One is a ruler in the third dungeon that has a dog's face. And this one's called Arkarok. Anubis would be part of that sort of category of dog or jackal kind of gods. And we get a dog god in the Bible. His name is Nebas, and the Avim worshipped him. Avim were post-diluvian giants, and Nebas, as you take that back to Hebrew, means a barking god, and says it was he was depicted with a human body and a dog's head. And of course, we have all sorts of mythos that have been out there ever since with us in our history and prehistory of dog Nephilim and dog Min. You also have a ruler that's in the fifth dungeon that had a black bull's face, and his name is Markur. And in the sixth dungeon, there's a wild boar face, and his name, according to this Gnostic gospel, was Lamechmor. And then you have one with a bear's face named Lucar. And you have one with a vulture's face, which we can sort of label to a cherubim-type face, and that was Lararok. And then you have one with a serpent face as well. So you go through, and you got these different kinds. And what that is suggesting is that these other angels that are in the hierarchy that we don't get descriptions of, that would be like the Dunamis, which are mighty ones, or powers as they're understood as, or principalities, which is Greek arche, or authorities, which is ascousia, sometimes translated as powers. And you have dominions, which are kartachi. We don't get descriptions of these angels. We know what the seraphim look like. We know what the archangels look like. We know what the angels look like. We know what the cherubim and the ophanim look like. But we don't know what these ones look like. And one might infer that these were faces of other ranks of angels that were also violating the laws of creation. And so they may have been smaller in size, or they would have may have been the same size, but they would have passed on that look if they took that look in the physical body. But when we're talking about the word giant, getting back to your question, we need to understand that, you know, if you're looking at even a post-diluvian giant that is somewhere between the average size is about 12 feet tall, so like Orontes in Greek mythology, Achilles, they're about 12 feet tall. 12 feet's kind of the standard. Goliath, which is over 1,000 years after the flood, he would have been 11 feet, 3 inches at 6 cubits and a span and using the royal cubit. So these were more than twice the height of humans. And the humans overall had a height-to-width ratio of 3-to-1, where these had a height-to-width ratio of 2-to-1 and were described in the King James Version Bible as stout, to sort of fit that description. And then we're provided Og's bed that sort of substantiates that height to width ratio. And that the structures, even of the smaller giant after the flood, distinctly different than humans. So these aren't just taller humans. And you couldn't get that tall unless you had some sort of supernatural preternatural type of DNA or force. But here's what Josephus says about the Anakim that were in Hebron. And then again, they are also a post-diluvian giant. And it said, and when they had taken it, they slew all the inhabitants. There were till then left the race of giants who had bodies so large and countenances so entirely different from other men that they were surprising to the sight and terrible to the hearing. The bones of these men are still shown to this very day, unlike to any credible relations of other men. So they had these giant bones on display in the time of the Exodus. Again, almost 1,000 years after the flood. And they're still were completely different than humans.
I think also, you know, it brought up the fact that they had elongated skulls. And, you know, we have seen elongated skulls in many places, certainly ancient. We're not seeing people with elongated skulls born anymore, but I'm thinking of, you know, Tutankhamun and his wife. They had elongated skulls. And when you look at the pictures, their faces did seem a bit snakish, and the long necks. And so I'm wondering if what we're seeing are not terrestrials as much as they are the DNA of the giants coming down through the DNA of humanity.
Yeah, it's the only way you can account for elongated skulls is this comes from a different DNA, just as the bone structure would be. And so it was common both before and after the flood for humans to try and emulate the look of the gods. So that what they would do, they would bind children's or baby skulls until they became elongated to give you that similar effect.
Mm-hmm.
But what you and it would look elongated. But what you can't do in binding is increase the volume of the cortex or of the skull. And these ones are so much bigger in volume than humans, the ones that they found throughout history and continue to find. And they also have the giant ones with the elongated skulls. They also have, they are sutureless, whereas humans have sutures. So then they're different. And when you look at depictions of these ancient kings, and we get most of the ones we see are post-Diluvian or after the flood, they're wearing these humongous hats over these elongated skulls. So Akhenaten would be a classic example, and same with Nefertiti of that same period. And you can get pictures on the internet where you'll see him and he's got these big, huge elongated hat that he's wearing to cover his elongated skull, which is monstrous. And you can get statues and reliefs showing the size of this elongated skull without the hat on. And if you look at Akhenaten, what's so interesting about him is that, again, he would have reigned in about 1200 BC. Some people try and date him back to 1400 BC using a different chronology, but somewhere in that range, so somewhere around 1,000 years after the flood, from the biblical timing, and if you're using secular chronology, that would be over 1,500 years. He has the face of a serpent. If you look at his long protruding chin, his thin lips, his very high cheekbones, his large wraparound eyes, and this elongated skull, and the eyes of the giants would shine, and they could light up a room. And they were called the Shining Ones. It was part of what they inherited from their preternatural fathers. And not only were they called the Shining Ones, but angels and gods were shining beings. And if they kept their spirit form, they're opalescent and shining, and they would just be just sort of light for the most part that you would see. And there may be a form that's moving in it, but it's a spiritual form. But if they took a physical form, then they would get that halo look all around their body and would have a superior and more magnificent sort of shine to it than what could be projected just by the eyes of these giants. So if you could imagine offspring of the seraphim with these serpentine elongated skulls with their eyes shone that were two, three, four times the size of humans and maybe more before the flood, and that their voices would just vibrate like Atlas, as is described in mythology, you know, bellowing from the depths of the earth and having it vibrate throughout. That's why Josephus says they were fearsome to the sight as well, and they were also understood to be fearsome to the smell, and they would have this sort of sulfur sort of smell about them as well. And so they're, and then not only are they so large, but they're so wide as well. These were muscular beings. They would be built more like a NFL lineman or a WWF wrestler in terms of that muscle and bulk. But they were also absolutely perfectly designed fighting machines, and they were ambidextrous, and they were fleet of foot. And I give accounts of all of this as I go through section one and section two on all of it, and just to give people an idea of what the demigods were. And yes, they were called demigods because they were the spurious offspring of their celestial mafia godfathers. And demigod was understood in ancient history as the offspring of a god or a goddess and a human, a female or male. And yes, in polytheism, both the goddesses and the gods produced offspring, just as after the flood you had Nin mating with King Lugalbanda to produce Gilgamesh. And so that is common in polytheism. Biblically, we sort of think that only they only took a male form, but we can see the pantheon, and it's got the male and female gods and goddesses. So it's a standard in polytheism. And so when we look at what these giants had the capability of doing in terms of their divine nature, they were known as the heroes of old or the mighty ones. So in Genesis 6:4, where it says mighty ones, that's the Hebrew word gibor, and gibberim is the plural, and it was used to describe the giants because they were so mighty and strong. And you also have a translation with the NIV that they were not called mighty ones. They used the term heroes of old. And heroes were what they called the offspring of the watchers and human males and females. So Gilgamesh was a hero. And all of the giants associated with Uruk were the heroes of Uruk. They were heroes in Greek mythology, just as Hercules, son of Zeus, and Alcmene, human female, was a hero and a titan. So just as you have titans of the earth in Greek mythology, you also have titans of heaven. And in many polytheist cultures around the world, the sons of God were also known as the sons of heaven. And you can sort of take that back to the Hebrew meaning, where the sons of God that are talked about in Genesis 6 are the Nephilim, as you understand them as the fallen angels. That's the fallen ones, and it's the source word for Nephilim. And they were of the heavenly ones. And heaven in Hebrew is Shema singular, which doesn't show up in the Bible, only Shemaim for the heavens in plural. And you can also pronounce that as the heavenly ones, or define that as, or and translate it as the heavenly ones, just as the seraphim are the serpent ones. And just as the cherubim are these four-faced ones, and just as the Nephilim are the giant ones, and just as the gibberim are the mighty ones, you see the consistency there. These are the Nephilim of the Shemaim, and their offspring were the sons of the heavenly ones, or the sons of heaven. And so you have the Nephilim of heaven and you have the Nephilim of the earth. You have the Anunnaki of heaven and the Anunnaki of the earth. You have the watchers, as they were understood in Sumeria, of heaven, and the watchers, which were the giants of the earth that watched in the great cities over their religious centers and capital cities of those empires. And again, that's a standard term that goes all around the cultures around the world.
Well, you know, it makes greater sense as to why there was a rebellion if the earth was theirs first. And it also makes greater sense why they are trying to wipe out humanity, because it was taken from them when God created Adam, and that bloodline started to multiply and, you know, be fruitful and multiply. It's easier to, it's not right, but it's easier to understand their anger when they were asked to bow down to Adam, and Lucifer said, "I'm not. No, I don't think so." I never understood. You know, I don't know why. I just had the feeling that, you know, gods were here to watch over humans, and therefore they got, you know, they got tested, and they decided to have children with pretty women. But when you look at it this way, when you understand that they were here first and that God decided to put humans down here too, I can understand their anger. It's sort of like, you know, I don't think so. Find another planet. I find it so much easier to understand what happened. Not that it was good, but yeah.
Yeah. So, and a lot of people say, well, you know, if there are giants, why don't we have, you know, recordings of that, or why don't we have the bones of that? Well, we have the skulls, and mm-hmm. their bones have been discovered throughout our history. Even in the U.S., you have discoveries of giants. I mean, the tallest one that was discovered was in Pennsylvania. That's 18 feet tall, in West Hickory, Pennsylvania. And you have California, you have a 12-foot giant, a 10-foot giant in Arkansas. There's actually a site that you can go to for old newspaper stories, and people want to get a hold of me, I can send you the link. It has a spreadsheet of all of these giants that were discovered, and they went to the university, who then sent them to the
Smithsonian.
The Smithsonian, yeah, and then they're not seen of again, or Smithsonian was contacted directly and they're not seen again. Mm-hmm. And if you go, you get the description in the spreadsheet, and as you go across the spreadsheet, there's a link to the newspaper article that you can actually go read and bring up and see the newspaper and the date of it. And they were discovered between about 1850 and about 1950, in that sort of zone. And we have the history of it. It's just that it's not well published, and it's generally suppressed. And that, you know, it's amazing how many states that, you know, giant bones were found in the U.S. It's absolutely incredible, you know, from Alabama to Wisconsin, from New York to California, from Texas to Montana. It's just, it's all around. And the First Nations give descriptions of the giants with red hair, elongated skull, living in caves, and they were the mortal enemies of humans. So we also get recorded in later history, when we get biblical ones, we get in Greek mythology, like I was talking about, like Achilles, which was 12 feet, and Orontes and others. But we get even in the time of the Roman Empire, when they were doing like gladiator fights and things like that, you had two that were named as Passio and Secundilia. I mean, they were 10 feet 3 inches in the time of Augusta. In the time of Claudius, you had Gabarus that was 9 feet 4 inches tall. And the largest giant skeleton found was in 1934, and that was about 31 feet that I found that I can look at with any sort of reliability. Mm-hmm. But those are just a few examples that come out of Roman history. And typically, most people accept the accountings and the accuracy of the Roman historians, unless, of course, it doesn't fit the narrative that's trying to be put out there.
Well, it seems that, you know, they were most, a lot of them, wiped out by the flood. But then it seems that they did persevere, so that, you know, maybe they could swim well, I don't know. But they reappear after the flood. And then, of course, you've got Adam and Eve, and you've got that whole bloodline thing. But but the Nephilim are still here. They're still working against humanity because they want to destroy it. And you have to, you know, admire they have all of the time in the world because they are part divine. But it's sort of like you've got the white hats and the black hats again, and you've got the good and the bad, and you've got a struggle on this planet that in many ways didn't start on this planet at all. It's almost as though this war was brought to this planet where it's being fought, and it's not being fought celestially, it's being fought physically here on the planet.
Yeah, you know, as what is understood in polytheism, as above, so below, right? So it's playing, and you could look at that as above as in heaven, or above as in the earth, and Hades as below. So you could run that either way, the way they like to word that. So yeah, what we are seeing playing out is the physical manifestation of that war that is sort of ongoing. And if you look at the Adamites, as we've talked about, as a different creation as the people of day six, they're created as the resolution to this angelic rebellion, which puts the Adamites in the crosshairs of the fallen angels who created the giants to ensure or try to ensure and endeavor to destroy humanity, to ensure to first enslave them and then to wipe them from memory, to wipe them from the face of the earth so that they do not reach their destiny. And that's so that the fallen angels don't get blood on their hands. And they know the power of God. And so even in the rituals that where you had human sacrifices to the gods, it was the humans doing it, not the fallen angels doing those sacrifices, because they're not going to cross over for you know, the red line, so to speak, in fear of what El Elyon, the God Most High, might do to them before the allotted time. And so they use their offspring to do the things that they don't want to do. You don't hear even Satan in the Bible disparaging God. You don't hear Iblis disparaging God in the Quran. Iblis is the name for Satan in the Quran, if people weren't aware of that. But you hear humans and giants slandering God, just as the Antichrist figures slander God, and Antichrist in the end time will slander God and all the angelic beings. These are the beasts. These are the spiritual beasts, and that they don't know the full power of God, and they've been deluded by the gods that they worship. And so they do the bidding of their gods, and these are the invisible ones, and the visible ones are the spirit's offspring until their bodies die, and then they become invisible ones as well as part of the demonic realm that are subservient to Satan and the fallen angels in the hierarchy.
So after the flood and after the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve are expelled, then you have the children of Cain and the children of Seth. And it feels as though that battle is then ongoing on a human level, and it mirrors the angelic battle.
It does, and that's one of the things I'm trying to lay out in section one, is to give more context to what is going on in the ancient world. So when in the creation of the Adamites, after the creation of the people of day six, you have Adam and Eve who are going to produce Cain, Abel, and Seth as the first three progeny. And of course, Cain kills Abel and gets ostracized and banned from from being with Adam and Eve. And then Seth is born sometime later when Adam is 130 years old. And so you've created two strains at this point in time. The Sethites, and beginning with Enosh, and as Genesis 4 talks about, the Sethites, beginning with Enosh, son of Seth, is going to return to God after the fall in Eden. But the Cainites, and his first son Enoch, and their descendants, Cain never forgives God for his ostracizing and sent out into this world where he's given a special mark as a sign of protection by the God Most High so that other people don't kill him. The only way you could understand that is there's people of day six, just as when he goes east to Eden, he chooses a wife, which there should be none there because Seth's not even born at this point in time. And then builds a city. Well, for who? Nobody's there. And the city's already named Nod. And so you get all of these details that would be just completely in conflict and nonsensical unless you understand that there's two different creations and there's a larger story. And so you get a genealogy of the Cainites and the Sethites. These are, from a polytheist version, the white hats and the black hats. And these are the rebellious ones from a monotheist perspective, right? And depending on which lineage or belief system you're in, you're going to look at whether God is the good one or Satan is the good one and vice versa for the opposite side of the coin on that. So you've got these two bloodlines that are created, and one is worshiping the pantheon of gods. And so Cain with Enoch, they are going to do something very unique. And it's very important to sort of understand this sort of level of what's going on in the antediluvian epoch. And Cain, according to the Polychronicon and the history of Freemasonry, receives knowledge from Adam. Adam learned all of this knowledge in that recollection of running this monstrous facility that went from the Nile to the Euphrates River, from Mount Hermon to the Sea of Aqaba and the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean on the south. And there was orchards there when you take those words back to the original Hebrew. Then there were fields of wheat and other grass crops. There were domesticated animals. And this is an incredible piece of property for one individual to run. And then God decides he's going to have a partner to help him. So now you have two people that can run this whole place. And so in order to do that, he would have had to have a lot of knowledge. The question gets is how much knowledge from a Christian perspective Jewish perspective would we expect that Cain or Adam would have had? I think it would be significant, whether or not it's to the same level as what the polytheists and the Gnostics and secret societies would suggest. We're just talking about degree, but this knowledge is passed on to Cain and to Abel, but of course Abel is murdered by Cain. And then Cain passes it on to Enoch, his son, and Enoch funnels this information into the seven sacred sciences that we would understand as the seven liberal arts today. So if people aren't all that familiar with them, the names of it aren't going to make you think, well, this was, crazy sort of technology, but what they do with it and who they partner with takes it to the level of technology that we're just trying to catch up to this day. So grammar, rhetoric, dialectics, arithmetic, geometry, or masonry as it's known in the craft, music, and astronomy. And those are the seven sciences that they're going to develop the different levels of knowledge in that. And then out of the first three, grammar, rhetoric, and dialectics, philosophy is going to be developed. And philosophy is the theology of polytheism. And philosophy is believed superior to the rest of the sciences because it acts as the arbiter between them and harmonizes all of them together and guides it in the application and the direction that they're going. And philosophy is the love of Sophia. Sophia is the mother goddess of Gnosticism, the mother goddess of the knowledge religion, which polytheism is. It's a knowledge religion, and you learn that knowledge as you go up in the degree, starting at third degree adept level into however high it goes in the old system. And Sophia is the one who created the 12 archons, that they would include Satan amongst and God and being equals from a polytheist perspective. And so this philosophy was used to develop the what they called the absolute in the antediluvian time. It was the supreme ideal real. And it was a level of technology that could destroy the earth, and some people even speculate the universe if they let it loose. And how it got there was with the merging of the knowledge of the gods in polytheism, and in the book of Enoch, the watchers that provided them the knowledge, and Azazel is the one who provides the most knowledge and the most critical knowledge to parading the world into destruction. And we get this bank of knowledge that's understood in polytheism throughout history. And it's known as, you know, the knowledge that's in the hidden vaults of Enoch in sort of its more pure tradition. It's known as the Pearls of Wisdom. It's known as the Archive of the Masons. It's known as the Emerald Tablet. It's known as the Golden Fleece. It's known as the Tables of the Destiny of the Anunnaki. It's the Golden Apples. It's the Hall of Records. It's the Smergina Hermeticus and the Table of Ham, the Rainbow Treasure at the end of the rainbow, and the Tablets of Technology, or the Shatia, also in Jewish mysticism. It's known by more names than that all around the world. It's a common history, just as all of this is a common history, because giants were created all over the world in the same way. And you know, we have this knowledge that is used to develop the world in the time, and it really goes on steroids in the generations of Lamech of the Cain line, and with his sons Tubal-Cain, Jabal, and Nama, and that this knowledge has the ability to destroy the earth by fire through war, which is going to bring the world to its knees, and if there's not an intercession, the wars that the giants are causing all over the world. And the best sort of polytheist example would be Atlantis, with the 10 kings of the Atlantean Empire trying to conquer the world, and is destroyed by the flood, by the gods in polytheism, to prevent all this violence from progressing. So when it says in Genesis 6, with the creation of the giants, and then God says the whole earth was corrupted and the violence was throughout the world and the godlessness was throughout the world, this is all references to the power of the religion that comes out of the sciences to protect it, which is Enochian mysticism, which is a sun worshiping bull cult. And the same religion that is passed on to the post-diluvian world, it's part of the organizational structure of the giants when they're created in the sixth generation. And the giants usurp the kingships, usurp the religion, usurp the knowledge, and reserve it for the top two classes of the four class system to enslave humankind, and are there to lead humankind away from God with this religion, just as Cain did the same thing with the Cainites. And so the goals of the seven sacred sciences are to lead people away from God, number one. Number two is to slander the God of the Bible. Number two, three is not to give him credit for anything. And number four is to honor their pantheon of gods in everything that they do. And we see that in the seven liberal sciences even to this day. And that's not that knowledge is good or evil. It's how it's used that is the issue.
What is confusing is did not Adam give Seth the same information? And was that bloodline corrupted by the sixth generation as well? What I'm hearing is that no matter which bloodline you are looking at, it was corrupted. And so that we're in the middle of corruption from all sides. So it's hard to know who's the good guy.
Yeah, good point. And so two things on that before I get to really answering it is that even the DNA was corrupted. Even the plant genomes were corrupted. And it says the whole earth and everything on the earth was corrupted, not the sea, but the earth. And so that's the Hebrew word shakath, which means to pervert, to ruin, mm-hmm. to decay, to destroy. And so, yes, by the sixth generation, according to Josephus and other accounts, and we don't get that sort of smoking gun on that, with that exact wording, that the Sethian line had become corrupted as well and become polytheist. And only Noah was pure in spirit, pure in physical DNA. And he's the one that's selected. Now, the knowledge is taught to Seth as well. Does Adam take some corrections to how he passed on the knowledge to Cain and Abel? We're not told that. From the polytheist side, Seth would have been taught all of this knowledge as well, but they tended to limit their focus to astronomy and whatever it took to be an agrarian society, and that even Noah and his family, even after the flood, were considered people of the field or agrarians after the flood and vegetarians. And so we don't know exactly what Seth was taught, but what he did do was they taught it in, and this is recorded as well in the Gnostic and the Masonic accounts, is that they taught the pure form, whereas polytheism, now some of these records within the secret societies also say they kind of discount this aspect of it, but they do have their records that suggest that it was the corruption of the seven sciences and polytheism that was done by the Cainite and the Enoch side. And so in that account, where you have in polytheism with Noah keeping the application to being good and not corrupting the sciences to do evil and do the things that the Enochians of Cain were doing. He starts off again after the flood with the good version, and then it later after that becomes corrupted again. Whereas the other version in the Polychronicon and Masonic history has both the evil side being passed on after the flood through the two pillars of Lamech and or Enoch, depending on which account you're having, and being found by Hermes or Hermine and taken to Nimrod at Babel, where the sciences and Enochian mysticism start up again begins. So what we do know, though, is the whole world except for Noah is corrupted. And his three sons and the three daughters that are selected for the sons and Noah's wife, of course, for the eight. So, but the knowledge does cross the flood, and we need to know that this thing completely continues. Now, for the people that are Christian and are saying, are you saying that Enoch was evil? Yes, Enoch was evil, but this is Enoch, son of Cain, and we need to understand that in the book of Genesis, you have Enoch, son of Jared as well. And he's the holy one, right? So we have two Enochs. And so we have to separate them. And whereas the Gnostics and the secret societies, they tend to conflate them, and they did that with the rise of Christianity so they wouldn't be persecuted. So they say, oh, no, we're talking about the good Enoch with his knowledge and stuff like that. And so, and there's two Lamechs. In fact, I put both genealogies side by side in book one, all the names are almost the same. There's a little bit, you know, differences of some of the names with the spelling, but the phonetics of it is essentially the same. And what the polytheist version is that the monotheist is a contrived, invented lineage. So they don't look at the complete Noah line as being the legitimate line, and they counterfeited the names to create a royal sort of bloodline. But there's two bloodlines of humans there that are ongoing in the antediluvian world, and it's the corruption of the Cain line and the following of polytheism. They're the ones who are going to provide, at least originally, the daughters to marry with the sons of God to produce the giants. And Nama is one of those classic ones, and she's one of the four that are listed, along with the other great patriarchs of Freemasonry and ancient Masonry, which are Jubal, and Tubal-Cain, as well as Enoch, son of Cain, and Cain, super patriarchs, along with Nimrod, who writes the first constitution for the Masons after the flood, and applies the knowledge to build Babel City and Babel Tower after the flood. So all of this is going on. And you have these two competing cultures and religions, and then the interjection of the demigods in the days of Jared and Noah as you get towards the latter part of the antediluvian age. And this is recorded in all cultures around the world. It's a common legacy. One is told through a monotheist lens, the other one's told through a polytheist lens. And so some of the details are a little bit different, but the direction and the macro story is talking about the same set of events.
What, you know, I got it. I mean, the similar names do get a bit confusing. It's not like there was a shortage of names that, you know, they could have made it different. But you know, I come to the point where if everything has been corrupted before and after the flood, then where do you find purity? Where do you find truth? And where do you find redemption?
And it's a good question because from how, I mean, why would there be a difference? Well, it's only if you accept that there was no surviving concept or people practicing good and practicing the ways of God were to disappear. It gets close after the flood, but you start off with eight, and many of them are going to get corrupted. And through the Shem line, you're going to get a series of a genealogy that goes down to Abraham. And you can make a good story that if Abraham is selected out of Sumeria to go to live in the covenant land filled with giants and Canaanite hybrid giants to start monotheism again, there may not be any other monotheists by the time of Abraham, and he's the last one. But it continues with Abraham and the knowledge of God and his knowledge through him down through into Israel. Now, the polytheists would suggest that that was completely corrupted as well, but that's you know, that's the flip side of the coin, looking at Christians as being evil, and that they're not the corrupt side. They're the ones who are the good ones. So in the beginning of the show, we talked about the tripartite tractate, which was a Gnostic gospel that referred to the organization. And it was a secretive, mysterious organization of ancient history and prehistory that fights against the dark forces of ignorance while preserving ancient knowledge and building impressive polytheist monuments to represent spiritual places. And so they look at themselves as the good ones. They look at themselves as the white hats. They look at themselves as being the beings of light and the ones who are not trying to enslave humankind in ignorance, and that you have free will to do what you want on this earth, which we all do. It's just there's consequences for it, but they have a different understanding of doing free will without consequences versus consequences. And so, and that they believe that we are, you know, that Christians and monotheist Jewish people are evil ones, and one would presume those loyal to from an Islamic perspective that they believe is the God of the Bible, that with that being said as a monotheist religion and that being the honest truth that they believe that, then they would be looked upon as evil as well by the polytheists, because they're a monotheist religion by their definition. So we have to understand the two lenses that are being looked at. And these two choices was there between the loyal angels and the fallen angels. It was there between Cain and the Cainites and Sethites. It was there between the hybrids of the giants and the Cainites versus the Sethites. It shows up again after the flood with Noah and the humans, who then become corrupted except for the Shem line, and you have the Shem line, and then you have the corrupted human line again, and giants somehow, somewhere that show up after the flood. And this continues to this day. And so they look at this as I shouldn't just say they on it. It's looked upon probably on both sides, and I would encourage both sides to step back from this, that this is a fight between sort of survival of each, that both cannot be here at the same sort of time. But there, this does come to a head several times throughout history, and there's another head coming to fruition in the end time again. And so there is this ongoing conspiracy, though, to corrupt humankind, to enslave humankind, and to ensure that they do not make their destiny. And so they're there to destroy as many people as they can.
Well, you have also the aspect of Lucifer coming in here and sort of directing traffic. It feels like that he is. It's interesting. He stands back and doesn't get his hands dirty, but he seems to be the individual that is controlling everything, kind of like, I didn't do it, they did it, so they get punished. And at one point, watchers are being thrown into the pit, and Lucifer can still walk around in heaven. It isn't quite that literal, but you know, he isn't punished. But the other angels he was
degraded,
in control.
Yeah, he's degraded to Satan status from the chief angel and the most powerful angel. So he gets almost like a plea agreement for a temporary stay. He's not sent to the pit prison, one deduces, because he did not create any giants himself. What he did was he corrupted loyal angels to follow him, and then convinced them, persuaded them, or influenced them to create the giants to destroy humanity, so that humanity won't be raised up in the future time to be like angels and to judge the fallen angels, as the New Testament tells us. So it's his time is coming, though. And as the period of the Adamites play out, so that all the names in the Book of Life that were written in there from before creation have an opportunity to leave their name in that book or be blotted out, has a chance to leave their name in that book. So there is a set time that's timed by the completion of that complete list of names. So there is a time frame for this. But Satan is above the fray, so to speak, as you say, and he is the leader of the fallen angels. He is the one who sits above the council of the gods. That's described in Psalms 82 that rules over the 70 nations that's talked about both before and after the flood. In Deuteronomy 32, where all the earth and the peoples and the nations were split up amongst the sons of Israel. And in this case, before the flood, it was numbered by the sons of Adam. We get that number through the table of nations after the flood as 70, and also numbered by the sons of Jacob before in Exodus 1:5, born in Egypt. That even though they're not named, Adam would have had 70 sons for the 70 nations before the flood. And that word Israel means ruling God or the reigning God. And so the sons of Israel is the sons of the reigning God that the whole earth was divided amongst. And that's an important dual prophecy in Deuteronomy 32 that gives that important prehistory information. It's applicable for the time of the Exodus, because Israel is about to take their covenant land, the land of God that he's gifted to Israel. That's about to happen. So it's a prophecy that's going to be for Israel in that period. And Israel is a title that's given to Jacob to change his name to, but it's a compound word of Sarah and El, El being an angel or a god, and Sarah is being reigning or ruler. And so it's also a prophecy for the millennium when the sons of Israel will be sitting over the nations of the world for the millennium. So it's important to sort of understand that Satan's involved, but so are the seven wandering stars, the seven Satans, of as they're called in the book of Enoch, and that these Satans are the ones that are going to lead the fallen angels and will be part of the 200 that initially create the giants before the flood, probably do a second incursion again after the flood. And well, not those 200, I would suggest, be careful I don't contradict myself. Another set of angels would create giants after the flood if there was a second incursion. Offspring gods in that case, like Baal, son of El, Zeus, son of Kronos, Anki, son of Anu, just to give a couple of quick examples. And so Satan didn't go to the pit prison because he didn't violate the laws of creation. He had other people do them. It's not that he will not receive his punishment. He'll go to the pit prison after the whole testimony and the crimes against the Adamites have been completed. So he'll go to the pit prison for 1,000 years and then to the lake of fire at the end of the millennium, where the angels that violated these laws to create the giants and other violations against creation that corrupted the whole earth, those are the ones that went to the pit prison before the flood. And if they did the same thing after the flood with the offspring gods, they also went there, but other angels would have moved up to, in the Hebrew Saba, army of angels, host of heaven, would have moved up with the rank and order and just promoted up and still run the council of the gods that Satan sits above in Psalms 82. And that's a different council than God has in heaven. It's council in Psalms 82 is the Hebrew root Eda, where it is Moed in Isaiah 14. And Isaiah 14 tells the rebellion of Satan when he tries to raise his home, is thrown up to heaven to be like God and to reign over the council in heaven, but has to settle for the one on earth.
Question. Now, the fallen angels are the angels that rebelled against God. And
yes,
the ones that were sent to the pit were the ones that had married humans. Are there fallen angels on the earth plane now that didn't have children with humans, but are still fallen angels because they rebelled against God?
Yes. Yeah, and that's what we have to be aware of. Those are the invisible ones of the Council of the Gods, that the visible ones, their spurious offspring and their descendants, still answer to and communicate with.
So we still have corruptors in our midst, no matter what.
Yep. Yes.
How do they impact humanity if they are invisible?
Well, what we don't get since the time of the original offspring gods after the flood, so sometime around Babel or shortly after, that series of violators went to the pit prison as well. And those were the ruling offspring gods, because even in, like in the Ugaritic text, for example, they're trying to bring Baal and Anat back to create more Rephaim after the flood, because they're having a fertility issue. So, but we still have these invisible ones. We don't see them or have a record of them, at least from a biblical perspective, that they will still take physical forms after that second incursion or after Babel. I'm not saying they can't. We just don't get that physical sort of recollection biblically. We just get the spiritual sort of aspect. So one sort of deduces from a Christian perspective that new parameters or restrictions were set on after the second incursion to create the giants after the flood. But they're still there, and they still have powers. They still have the ability to influence the earth. And so they have been using ever since, and you don't see the same power of the gods being enacted sometime after the flood. You have these gods, but they have only have idols of gods, but they can't really do that much compared to what they used to be able to do. They don't walk amongst humans after a certain period of time after the flood. So there's something that's happened, but the invisible ones are still controlling the visible ones. And they are promising immortality to their spirit offspring and the descendants and the generations thereafter. And so they still continue to lead, and they still have power, just not the same level of physical power, I think, than, you know, let's say like Baal or Osiris did after the flood, or Anu and Kronos had before the flood. So I think there's a distinction in terms of that, a demonstration of that physical power. But I also know that in the end time, before the midpoint of the last 7 years, is the pit prison is going to be opened up.
Uh-huh.
And those fallen angels are coming back. So,
it just reminds me a little bit of, the story of selling your soul to the devil, that something can whisper in someone's ear, and I think of Hitler, and I think of, you know, men that were just so ferocious and so whatever that you just can't believe that they were still human, that in a way they were influenced by something other than the situations at hand, that there's something else pushing them to be evil. And I'm wondering if these invisible ones are looking for the weak-minded that can be influenced like that and doing manipulation that way.
Yeah, and also adding additional power to those who are going to permit either a fallen angel or a demon into them. It's not always clear to me when the polytheists are being possessed or avatared, whether or not it's a demon spirit or it's a fallen angel spirit. And it could be a little bit of both. We do know that fallen angels can be an avatar for an avatara. As an example, Buddha was the avatara after he was born. So he already mm-hmm. has a spirit, already has a soul, already has a body. And soul and body is the Oikitarian. And so Vishnu made Buddha his avatar. And it's a symbiotic relationship. And Buddha received additional wisdom and knowledge, and he started a new religion. And so Vishnu was an avatar probably 18 or 20 times, just as Shiva was the destroyer god. And so in the Bible, we know Satan can do this as well. And he enters into Judas at the time of Jesus. And because Judas is requiring additional strength and courage to go through with betraying Jesus. And so, so he enters into him. So we know that that can happen, but that's more of that symbiotic relationship that adds power. Typically, we understand the disembodied spirits of the giants as demons and evil spirits and unclean spirits. And when they enter into a human body that has a spirit already in that soul and body, it's not symbiotic. There's a war going on between the two hosts, and the demon spirit's trying to possess the human spirit, so they have a place of rest and an ability to interact with the physical world. But within the polytheist religions, it's their belief, and I don't know whether it's accurate or it isn't, but they believe that you can bring in certain kinds of spirits into you, whether it's a trickster spirit, whether it's of an angel or a demon spirit, into your body, or a spirit that's going to add additional knowledge or power to you, and that you can control those demon spirits. Now, in polytheism, they do believe that they learn rituals and words, and if they learn the name of the original demon, that they can control them. So maybe you can control the demon that way, or maybe it's just the demon in complete control at that point, and you never hear from the original host again. I don't know. All I know, it's a bad idea to do that. But nonetheless, that is the belief system, and that they will actively do that as an adept level, probably a high-level adept, so that they can become more powerful and successful on Earth. But one does want to be careful with that.
Isn't that what, who Solomon, didn't he have a ring that enabled him to control demons?
Biblically, we don't get told that. We get that out of one of the Apocrypha Gospels of Solomon, and from the Quran also says that he could control demons. Mm-hmm. Do I think it's possible that he could? I think he had more knowledge than anybody on Earth at that time. So mm-hmm. I think he could have had that power. Whether or not he had to use a ring, probably not. That's more of a polytheist tradition. Rings are very, very important in the polytheist tradition. But I don't believe he used demons to build the temple. I think that would be too far.
Well, yeah, theoretically, yeah. But
it wouldn't make sense to use demons to build the Holy of Holies. So
no. Well, you talk about Satan's first revenge and Satan's second revenge. Is there a third revenge coming?
There have been many revenges, and yes, there is another revenge that's coming. So the first revenge is, as I talk about in chapter 13, is Satan working with the serpent to bring down Adam and Eve to eat from the knowledge of good fruit of the tree of good and evil. So that's the first revenge, and that is to, you know, make sure that humankind doesn't reach their destiny to be raised up like angels and to rule over angels as the inheritors of eternity. So it's in their interest to try and make sure that the Adamites don't succeed. And they actually probably thought that they succeeded at that point. The second revenge is the creation of the giants in Genesis 6 to create the spurious ones to do their beckoning. And so that's the second revenge, and it's almost successful, that they're trying to destroy the earth by fire through the angelic technology. And it's my speculation, you don't get scripture on this, is that they had the technology to destroy the world by fire.
Okay.
And so God either brings the flood, or he permits the angels to bring the flood, or he permits the fallen angels to bring the flood. In polytheism, it's the council of the gods that bring the flood to destroy humanity and the giants as their offspring that started to do too much violence. Biblically, it says that God brings the flood, but you could also interpret that as he permits it. So it's hard to know who brings the flood, but there's a destruction coming, but it won't be by fire because the flood prevents the world from being destroyed by fire. So when we look at 2 Peter 3 that I talked about, I'm just going to read it because it's very important. So it says in 2 Peter 3:5, it says, "For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with the water perished." Again, the flood didn't kill the whole world, just what was on the earth. So it's not there. And it's talk, so the water there is talking about that collapse of the waters above that separated to make the firmament in Genesis 1-2 for the renewal of the earth. But then it says, "But the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition and ungodly men." So the destruction that destroyed the earth in the beginning by fire has been reserved for another destruction by fire in the end time. So that's going to be the sort of the ultimate revenge that Satan's going to want to bring by the end time, is to destroy the whole earth again, except that Jesus is going to step in. And the angels know that they're going to lose by the time of Jesus. And they make a crucial mistake in the time of Jesus, because they ensure, as the princes of this world, and as it talks about in 1 Corinthians, that if the princes or the archons of this world had known about the resurrection, they wouldn't have ensured they had Jesus crucified. So they didn't know about the resurrection. They didn't know the ultimate plan that God had set in place with the Adamites. So from that point on, they're just trying to kill as many as possible because they know that they're going to lose, but they continue to deceive their followers and their spurious offspring that they can still win this battle. And so other revenges, lots of revenges. So you have Nimrod at Babel is another revenge of Satan to try and ensure humankind doesn't reach their destiny.
Mm-hmm.
You have, I won't go through all of them. You have Eliphaz and Esau, who are going to marry Horeem giants after the flood to create hybrid giants and to try and usurp the inheritance, messianic promise, and blessings by wiping Israel from the face of the earth. They're going to try and kill Jesus when he's a baby as part of the revenge to ensure the Messiah doesn't come. There's lots of revenges that Satan does, but the two biggest ones are the original fall and the creation of the giants. But the ultimate thing that he's working towards was to destroy humankind. He can't get there, but he's going to try and destroy the whole world, even though he knows God and Jesus can step in anytime that they want.
If indeed the angels and God are immortal and eternal and everything, and the angels were here originally for thousands of years, perhaps longer, why didn't they just pick up and go to another planet and let God have humanity here on this planet? Wouldn't that have solved all of this? I mean, there have to be other planets that they could have gone to.
Yeah, they wanted another realm of their own. I don't think that the fallen angels ever thought they could defeat God. What they're hoping for is that Satan could be like God in another realm, and the fallen angels would be in that other realm as well, to live on their own and out of the reach and authority of God. They're hoping to win that accommodation and as justification for their rebellion. God didn't permit that. He created them immortal and created them with intimate knowledge of God. Now, they all obviously don't know everything. Even the Son doesn't know everything because he doesn't know when the exact time and hour of his coming is. Only God knows. El Elyon only knows that. Mm-hmm. Not Jehovah of the Elohim or the Word of God. So not all the fallen angels don't know all things that God knows. So he knew they were going to rebel. He created them with free choice to follow him or not, and they would have intimate knowledge, but yet a full third of them rebelled. And so humankind is created as the resolution, and we were created mortal with little knowledge of God, and we have to choose God on faith. And for that, we will earn our adoption as sons of God, even though we have human fathers, as the New Testament tells us, versus angelic fathers, or God, as the Word of God, created at the command of God, all of the angels, Colossians 1, and that we will be adopted like that in the future time. So we're rewarded to be raised higher because we weren't mortal. We're thrown into this world where this fight's going on, and we're in the center of it. One side is letting it play out to convict the fallen angels by the crimes that they're committing as they're trying to justify their rebellion by saying even the humans are going to rebel. So if they rebelled, why would you save them and not save us or let us go into another realm, as we talked about? That's not going to be the case for either the humans that don't accept God and Jesus, or for the angels. For the humans, you have the second death, as talked about in Revelation 20, and you're not part of the resurrection sequence for eternity that happens before that. And for those who take the mark of the beast or worship Satan and Antichrist in the end time, they will burn forever in the lake of fire like the fallen angels are. And in Matthew 25, that lake of fire was created for the devil and his angels for their rebellion. So we're created in a different way with less knowledge to earn our immortality. They were granted that and already had it, but still chose to rebel. And so that's what's being played out here.
Well, is the pit and the prison, is that in another dimension, or is that theoretically underground here on the earth? It has to be another dimension or realm.
Yeah, I think it's in the earth in another dimension. And in that location of Hades, Sheol, the other world, the nether world, Argatha, all the different names throughout the world, is that's where the Tartarus or the pit prison or the abyss prison is also located in one section of that place that occupies the same space in the earth, but it's in another dimension. And so wherever Jesus went while he was in the grave, in that, he went into that dimension to visit the spirits that were already in there. And I think he was telling, when I rise up on Sunday, your rebellion is over. It's your fate is sealed. And so that's in First Peter, in the book of First Peter, people are looking toward Jesus does that while he's still in the grave.
Are they not given the choice to change?
They were already created perfect and earned their immortality. Once that was violated with the rebellion, then there is no reprieve on that. And what was said to them in the beginning, whatever oath they might have taken or whatever the rules were, we're not privy of. All we know is that whatever they did in the rebellion and the subsequent crimes that they did after that rebellion forfeits their ability for being part of eternity. Now, they will be part of eternity, because they're going to be punished in the lake of fire forever, but they're just not, part of the good part of eternity. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
So it's not clear, whereas humans, because we weren't already awarded with our immortality, there's an ability, you know, if we choose not to accept God and Jesus, then we get the second death. But if you choose to, like I say, with the mark of the beast, then that forfeits it. And it just seems to me that whatever the fallen angels did, they did something that's not forgiven. And in that is this very interesting passage in the book of Matthew that says the sacrifice of Jesus atones for all the sins of the world except for crimes and blasphemies. I add crimes as well, but blasphemies, as you take that into its nuanced meanings in the original Greek there, except for the blasphemies made against the Holy Spirit. Now, the Holy Spirit is understood in polytheism as a goddess or a female. And so counterfeiting the Holy Spirit as a goddess would be one of those blasphemies against the Holy Spirit. If you are creating giants, it's a violation against the laws of creation and a blasphemy against the Spirit, because they are providing a counterfeit spirit or a Xerox spirit that is passed on, which is immortal, into human flesh and creating the giants, which is why God limited the body life to 120 years in Genesis 6:3, because he didn't want physical spirits that have physically immortal bodies to live forever in the physical world. It's just a violation against the whole laws of creation. So that's one of the laws that some of those would have done. But anything that would violate whatever laws and is on the authority and domain of the Holy Spirit when it comes to life, whatever those rules are, they are held accountable to that within what they did. And again, we're not told exactly what all of those violations would be, but the fallen angels would have known that from the beginning. And so when you look at the oath that the 200 swore on Mount Hermon, Haram Anathema, which means, you know, an oath of carrying it out to the end, no matter what the consequences were, they clearly understood what they were doing. Now, what violations the other fallen angels who didn't violate the laws of creation, that didn't go to the prison, that they would be part of the same type of punishment with the lake of fire. They just weren't in the pit prison until the end time. I don't know, but it would have to have something done with their initial creation and whatever they were told at that time, and then whatever some of their actions were within that rebellion. So that's why it also makes more sense that if you had an angelic rebellion, that would be better placed between Genesis 1:1 and 2, because of all of the destruction of that world, that the Word had to recreate, and with the life-giving spirit of the Holy Spirit renewed the earth after that destruction. So there was a significant level of blasphemies and crimes or violations that would have been done probably before Genesis 1:1 and 2 that destroyed the old world that they would be held accountable for. And then with the restrictions that they were told that they could do with the creation of humans and the Adamites in the renewed world, as Psalms 104 talks about, when God sends his spirit, the earth is renewed, and the Holy Spirit is in Genesis 1:2 hovering over that chaos to re-separate those waters. Or after the separation of those waters, will go in and bring life to the earth again at the behest of God and in conjunction with the Word of God. So something happened there that convicted them, and it has to do with the Holy Spirit.
We're taking reincarnation into consideration. If someone is corrupted in life, pass away, their spirit comes around and comes back again, Is that spirit still corrupted or is it cleansed?
So biblically, we don't have a reincarnation doctrine. That's a polytheist doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But from a human perspective and from a Christian perspective, when humans die, their body goes to sleep in a sleep-like state, and so does their body and soul will go turn into dust, but the spirit sleeps and returns to heaven from where it came and will remain in that sleep status. Counterfeit spirits aren't permitted to go to sleep. Counterfeit spirits are going to roam the earth as demon spirits or have gone to the pit prison in the sides of the pit, as Ezekiel 32 references, as the terrible ones who did terrible things to humankind while they were on earth when they die. Or in the polytheist version, the third option is with the knowledge that they'll learn in their knowledge cult that they can find their way into Hades and Sheol where their gods rule from and be with their gods. Only three places that they can go, but their spirits don't sleep. Where they can't go, spirit is into heaven, because that spirit doesn't come from heaven. And the fallen angels, except for Satan, aren't permitted into heaven anymore. Satan is only permitted in to do his reporting back to God. so they're no longer allowed to be in heaven, but they will storm heaven just like they did in ancient history, just as Antichrist will in Daniel 8:10 will war with heaven and throw down some of the starry hosts. I think that's the same time as the war in heaven in Revelation 12, where Michael and his angels will throw all of the invading angels from the abyss and the council of the gods back down to the earth for the last 3.5 years. So we need to understand that reincarnation is a doctrine of the royales for them. It was never meant for the mundane, for the bottom two classes, even if you're a polytheist follower. It was a doctrine designed to give knowledge for when that body would be released from the body that was no longer immortal. And from Genesis 6:3 forward, the bodies were all no longer immortal from the creation of the fallen angels, which created the Nephilim and then the Rephaim after the flood. And so that was designed to help them find their way to the other world or Valhalla. It's the same story all around, but it's only the warriors and it's only the upper two classes that have that gene of Isis, or as I like to call it in book one, or the Albigens, or the Cretazens, or the Fabiagens, or the Albigens, or all the different genses around the world from specific Nephilim and Raphaim and Celestial Mafia Godfathers, only those spirits are allowed to have the true knowledge to find your way into heaven if you can get there. And there's ways where they believe, like if you lose your head, you're not getting there. You're probably going to the pit prison.
Well, yeah, one would think so. No, I just wondered because, you know, there's so much going on in this world today. And, you know, you see stuff, you know, exploding all over the place. You do wonder if there is influence of a negative nature on some spiritual level going on that is driving humanity to this kind of horror.
Yeah, we're always in a state of perpetual war. And it's a war between the leaders of the world who use humans as their foot soldiers and pawns, using two metaphors, in this ongoing rivalry of the bloodlines and this good versus evil. So you've got the macro level with Satan and God at the macro level, that the polytheists believe Satan is the equal of God, just as Satan and the God of the Bible were part of the 12 archons created by Sophia, just as one quick example, because I know our time's getting tight.
Yeah.
And you have the white hats and the black hats, or the good Nephilim and the evil Nephilim, or the white witches and the evil witches white magic, black magic that's in polytheism, but they still worship the same pantheon of the gods. But that's the physical manifestation of the rivalries that we see in the physical world. Same agenda, just one is more sympathetic to humankind, but the ultimate goal is the same thing versus the dark side that would just wipe us out completely before we get to the end time. That would be their goal. This is always sort of ongoing, and we need to understand that we are the fodder as humans in those rivalries around the world that eventually will produce one dragon messiah.
Yeah. I think that's what everybody doesn't. I think people just don't understand that we are the cannon fodder. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And from whichever side they're using us, but one is nicer to us as we go through, but the ultimate result will be the same thing. And so war was taught to the giants before the flood by Azazel. And Azazel taught all the arts and the crafts of war, how to make weapons, how to utilize it, and the technology that went with it. And it was why he's the scapegoat for all the sins of the antediluvian world, as it's recorded in the book of Enoch. And biblically, we get a second goat, a scapegoat that's sacrificed on the Day of Atonement for not described sins. One, the first goat is for the sins of Israel, but the second one goes into the wilderness or the abyss. And that Hebrew word for scapegoat in the KJV is Azazel. And I think that's a sacrifice for the sins of Azazel that was the destroyer of the antediluvian world and was degraded to goat god status, a satyr, as in a hairy goat god watcher, as you have a compound word of sair, of sa, which means hairy and goat, and several other words like it. And it's source words that go back to words goat as well. And then Ayir was the word for watcher, as we talked about at the beginning of the show. That's why he's depicted as a goat god, and part of that whole goat god ideology that originally he was seraphim. And as the leader of the fallen angels, he's going to be the destroyer who likely comes out of the pit prison in Revelation 9, just before the midpoint, to destroy the whole world. Again, attempting to do through fire, which he tried to do before the flood.
Wow. Well, we are, that's a lovely, lovely way to end. we are almost out of time. Your book has 8 different sections, and we are going to do a different section every week. And next week is section 2. So if you get the book and read along with us, it makes it more fascinating, and it also gives you more questions. But prior to that, if you want to get a hold of Gary, you want to give out your website and how to get a hold of you?
Yes, the Genesis6Conspiracy.com, that's Genesis6 with the number 6Conspiracy.com is my website. And on the website, you can get a signed copy from me. And under Buy Now, Buy from the Author, I have a Canadian page, a U.S. page, and then an international page for the whole world. So you buy book one or book two that way. You can also link over to BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, Amazon.ca. Also link over from the website for the Kindle edition from Amazon. If you want to contact me, there's a contact the author button. If you want to ask me a question or get a document on some of the things that I talked about tonight, I supply those at no charge. And the Audible version for book one came out about a month ago. And it is produced through Amazon ACX and another partner. And that it is available through Amazon Audible and through iTunes. So if you prefer the audio version, that's available. And book two, we're going to have a delay on that because the narrator, I selected the same narrator, he's had severe health issues and has flatlined 3 times and still surviving. And once he recovers, he'll do book two, because book two is just as big a challenge, if not bigger, to do than book one was, and he did a marvelous job on book one.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again. I look forward to section 2. I'll have all sorts of questions ready for you then. And this was fabulous. I'm looking so forward to the next show. So thank you for being here tonight and sharing all of your information with us.
Well, thank you. It was my absolute pleasure to do so. I know we covered a lot of territory, and that's just section one.
I know.
And we didn't cover everything in section one. So that tells you how much information might be in the book, and I would encourage people to put it as part of their collection.
Me too. Absolutely. This is a great read, and I've done it 3-4 times now, and I'll probably pick it up again in another. Well, I'm going to keep going. So do please get the book and read along with us. Good night now.